All right, then, said Wang Mu, but she still looked wary. Father says, and so does Pang Gu Wei, his very wise friend, who once took the examination for the civil service and came very, very close to passing. What do they say? That it is a very bad thing for Congress to send a huge fleet, and so huge, all to attack the tiniest colony simply because they refuse to send away two of their citizens for trial on another world. They say that justice is completely on the side of Lusitania, because to send people from one planet to another against their will is to take them away from family and friends forever. That's like sentencing them before the trial. What if they're guilty? That's for the courts to decide on their own world, where people know them and can measure their crime fairly, not for Congress to decide from far away where they know nothing and understand less. Wang Mu ducked her head. That's what Pang Guwei says. Qing Zhao stilled her own revulsion at Wang Mu's traitorous words. It was important to know what the common people thought, even if the very hearing of it made Qing Zhao sure the gods would be angry with her for such disloyalty. So, you think that the Lusitania fleet should never have been sent? If they can send a fleet against Lusitania for no good reason, what's to stop them from sending a fleet against Path? We're also a colony. Not one of the 100 worlds, not a member of Starway's Congress. What's to stop them from declaring that Han Feidza is a traitor and making him travel to some faraway planet and never come back for 60 years? The thought was a terrible one, and it was presumptuous of Wang Mu to bring her father into the discussion, not because she was a servant, but because it would be presumptuous of anyone to imagine the great Han Feidza being convicted of a crime. Jing Zhao's composure failed her for a moment, and she spoke her outrage. Starway's Congress would never treat my father like a criminal. Forgive me, Jing Zhao. You told me to repeat what my father said. You mean your father spoke of Han Feidza? All the people of Zhanlei know that Han Feidza is the most honorable man of Path. It is our greatest pride that the House of Han is part of our city. So thought Jing Zhao. You knew exactly how ambitious you were being when you set out to become his daughter's maid. I meant no disrespect, nor did they. But isn't it true that if Starway's Congress wanted to, they could order Path to send your father to another world to stand trial? They would never, but could they, insisted Wang Mu. Path is a colony, said Qing Zhao. The law allows it, but Starway's Congress would never. But if they did it to Lusitania, why wouldn't they do it to Path? Because the Xenologers on Lusitania were guilty of crimes that the people of Lusitania didn't think so. Their government refused to send them off for trial. That's the worst part. How can a planetary government dare to think they know better than Congress? But they knew everything, said Wang Mu, as if this idea were so natural that everyone must know it. They knew those people, those Xenologers. If Starway's Congress ordered Path to send Han Feidza to go stand trial on another world for a crime we know he didn't commit, don't you think we would also rebel rather than send such a great man? And then they would send a fleet against us. Starway's Congress is the source of all justice in the 100 worlds. Qing Zhao spoke with finality. The discussion was over. Impudently, Wang Mu didn't fall silent. But Path isn't one of the 100 worlds yet, is it? She said. We're just a colony. They can do what they want, and that's not right. Wang Mu nodded her head at the end, as if she thought she had utterly prevailed. Jing Zhao almost laughed. She would have laughed, in fact, if she hadn't been so angry. Partly she was angry because Wang Mu had interrupted her many times and had even contradicted her, something that her teachers had always been very careful not to do. Still, Wang Mu's audacity was probably a good thing, and Jing Zhao's anger was a sign that she had become too used to the undeserved respect people showed to her ideas simply because they fell from the lips of the gods spoken. Wang Mu must be encouraged to speak to her like this. That part of Jing Zhao's anger was wrong, and she must get rid of it. But much of Ching Zhao's anger was because of the way Wang Mu had spoken about Starway's Congress. It was as if Wang Mu didn't think of Congress as the supreme authority over all of humanity, as if Wang Mu imagined that path was more important than the collective will of all the worlds. Even if the inconceivable happened, and Han Feizi were ordered to stand trial on a world 100 light-years away, he would do it without murmur. And he would be furious if anyone on path made the slightest resistance. To rebel like Lusitania? Unthinkable. It made Ching Zhao feel dirty just to think of it. Dirty. Impure. To hold such a rebellious thought made her start searching for a wood grain line to trace. Ching Zhao! Cried Wang Mu, as soon as Ching Zhao knelt and bowed over the floor. Please tell me that the gods aren't punishing you for hearing the words I said. They aren't punishing me, said Ching Zhao. They're purifying me. But they weren't even my words, Ching Zhao. They were the words of people who aren't even here. They were impure words, whoever said them. But that's not fair. To make you cleanse yourself for ideas that you never even thought of or believed in. Worse and worse. Would Wang Mu never stop? Now must I hear you tell me that the gods themselves are unfair? They are! If they punish you for other people's words... The girl was outrageous. Now you are wiser than the gods. They might as well punish you for being pulled on by gravity or being fallen on by rain. If they tell me to purify myself for such things, then I'll do it and call it justice, said Ching Zhao. Then justice has no meaning, cried Wang Mu. When you say the word, you mean whatever the gods happen to decide. But when I say the word, I mean fairness. I mean people being punished only for what they did on purpose. I mean it's what the gods mean by justice that I must listen to. Justice is justice, whatever the gods might say. Almost, Ching Zhao rose up from the floor and slapped her secret maid. It would have been her right. For Wang Mu was causing her as much pain as if she had struck her. But it was not Jing Zhao's way to strike a person who was not free to strike back. Besides, there was a far more interesting puzzle here. After all, the gods had sent Wang Mu to her. Jing Zhao was already sure of that. So instead of arguing with Wang Mu directly, Ching Zhao should try to understand what the gods meant by sending her a servant who would say such shameful, disrespectful things. The gods had caused Wang Mu to say that it was unjust to punish Ching Zhao for simply hearing another person's disrespectful opinions. Perhaps Wang Mu's statement was true. But it was also true that the gods could not be unjust. Therefore, it must be that Ching Zhao was not being punished for simply hearing the treasonous opinions of the people. No. Ching Zhao had to purify herself because in her heart of hearts, some part of her must believe those opinions. She must cleanse herself because deep inside, she still doubted the heavenly mandate of Starway's Congress. She still believed they were not just. Ching Zhao immediately crawled to the nearest wall and began looking for the right wood grain line to follow. Because of Wang Mu's words, Ching Zhao had discovered a secret filthiness inside herself. The gods had brought her another step closer to knowing the darkest places inside herself, so that she might someday be utterly filled with light and thus earn the name that even now was still only a mockery. Some part of me doubts the righteousness of Starway's Congress. Oh, gods, for the sake of my ancestors, for my people, my rulers, and last of all for me, purge this doubt from me and make me clean. When she finished tracing the line, and it took only a single line to make her clean, which was a good sign that she had learned something true, there sat Wang Mu, watching her. All of Ching Zhao's anger was gone now. And indeed, she was grateful to Wang Mu for having been an unwitting tool of the gods in helping her learn new truth. But still, Wang Mu had to understand that she had been out of line. In this house, we are loyal servants of Starway's Congress, said Jing Zhao, her voice soft, her expression as kind as she could make it. And if you're a loyal servant of this house, you'll also serve Congress with all your heart. How could she explain to Wang Mu how painfully she had learned that lesson herself, how painfully she was still learning it? She needed Wang Mu to help her, not make it harder. "Holy One, I didn't know," said Wang Mu. "I didn't guess. I had always heard the name of Han Feizi mentioned as the noblest servant of Path. I thought it was the Path that you served, not Congress, or I never would have come to work here. Never would have spoken harshly about Congress," said Wang Mu. "I would serve you even if you lived in the house of a dragon." "Maybe I do," thought Qing Zhao. "Maybe the god who purifies me is a dragon, cold and hot, terrible and beautiful. Remember, Wang Mu, that the world called Path is not the path itself, but only was named so to remind us to live the true path every day. My father and I serve Congress because they have the mandate of heaven, and so the path requires that we serve them even above the wishes or needs of the particular world called Path." Wang Mu looked at her with wide eyes, unblinking. Did she understand? Did she believe? No matter. She would come to believe in time. "Go away now, Wang Mu. I have to work." "Yes, Qing Zhao." Wang Mu immediately got up and backed away, bowing. Qing Zhao turned back to her terminal, but as she began to call up more reports into the display, she became aware that someone was in the room with her. She whirled around on her chair. There in the doorway stood Wang Mu. "What is it?" asked Qing Zhao. "Is it the duty of a secret maid to tell you whatever wisdom comes to her mind, even if it turns out to be foolishness?" "You can say whatever you like to me," said Qing Zhao. "Have I ever punished you?" "Then please forgive me, my Qing Zhao, if I dare to say something about this great task you are working on." What did Wang Mu know of the Lusitania fleet? Wang Mu was a quick student, but Qing Zhao was still teaching her at such a primitive level in every subject that it was absurd to think Wang Mu could even grasp the problems, let alone think of an answer. Nevertheless, Father had taught her, servants are always happier when they know their voices are heard by their master. "Please tell me," said Qing Zhao, "how can you say anything more foolish than the things I have already said?" "My beloved elder sister," said Wang Mu, "I really got this idea from you. You've said so many times that nothing known to all of science and history could possibly have caused the fleet to disappear so perfectly and all at once." "But it happened," said Qing Zhao, "and so it must be possible, after all." "What came to my mind, my sweet Qing Zhao," said Wang Mu, "is something you explained to me as we studied logic, about first and final cause. All this time, you have been looking for first causes, how the fleet was made to disappear, but have you looked for final causes? What someone hoped to accomplish by cutting off the fleet, or even destroying it?" "Everyone knows why people want the fleet stopped. They're trying to protect the rights of colonies, or else they have some ridiculous idea that Congress means to destroy the Pecaninos along with the whole colony. There are billions of people who want the fleet to stop. All of them are seditious in their hearts and enemies of the gods." "But somebody actually did it," said Wang Mu. "I only thought that since you can't find out what happened to the fleet directly, then maybe you could find out who made it happen. That will lead you to find out how they did it." "We don't even know that it was done by a who," said Qing Zhao. "It could have been a what. Natural phenomena don't have purposes in mind, since they don't have minds." Wang Mu bowed her head. "I did waste your time then, Qing Zhao. Please forgive me. I should have left when you told me to go." "It's all right," said Qing Zhao. Wang Mu was already gone. Qing Zhao didn't know whether her servant had even heard her reassurance. "Never mind," thought Qing Zhao. "If Wang Mu was offended, I'll make it up to her later. It was sweet of the girl to think she could help me with my task. I'll make sure she knows I'm glad she has such an eager heart." With Wang Mu out of the room, Qing Zhao went back to her terminal. She idly flipped the reports through her terminal's display. She had looked at all of them before, and she had found nothing useful. Why should this time be different? Maybe these reports and summaries showed her nothing because there was nothing to show. Maybe the fleet disappeared because of some god gone berserk. There were stories of such things in ancient times. Maybe there was no evidence of human intervention because a human didn't do it. What would Father say about that? She wondered. How would Congress deal with a lunatic deity? They couldn't even track down that seditious writer Demosthenes. What hope did they have of tracking and trapping a god? Whoever Demosthenes is, he's laughing right now, thought Ching Zhao. All his work to persuade people that the government was wrong to send the Lusitania fleet, and now the fleet has stopped, just as Demosthenes wanted. Just as Demosthenes wanted. For the first time, Ching Zhao made a mental connection that was so obvious she couldn't believe she hadn't thought of it before. It was so obvious, in fact, that the police in many a city had assumed that those who were already known to follow Demosthenes must surely have been involved in making the fleet disappear. They had rounded up everyone suspected of sedition and tried to force confessions out of them. But, of course, they hadn't actually questioned Demosthenes because nobody knew who he was. Demosthenes. So clever, he has evaded discovery for years, despite all the searching of the Congress police. Demosthenes, who is every bit as elusive as the cause of the disappearance of the fleet. If he could work the one trick, why not the other? Maybe if I find Demosthenes, I'll find out how the fleet was cut off. Not that I have any idea even where to start looking, but at least it's a different avenue of approach. At least it won't mean reading the same empty, useless reports over and over again. Suddenly, Ching Zhao remembered who had said almost exactly the same thing only moments before. She felt herself blushing, the blood hot in her cheeks. How arrogant I was, to condescend to Wang Mu, to patronize her for imagining she could help me with my lofty task. And now, not 5 minutes later, the thought she planted in my mind has blossomed into a plan. Even if the plan fails, she was the one who gave it to me, or at least started me thinking of it. Thus, I was the fool to think her foolish. Tears of shame filled Ching Zhao's eyes. Then she thought of some famous lines from a song by her ancestor of the heart. I want to call back the blackberry flowers that have fallen, though pear blossoms remain. The poet, Li Qingzhao, knew the pain of regretting words that have already fallen from our lips and can never be called back. But she was wise enough to remember that even though those words are gone, there are still new words waiting to be said, like the pear blossoms. To comfort herself for the shame of having been so arrogant, Qingzhao repeated all the words of the song, or at least she started to. But when she got to the line, "Dragon boats on the river," her mind drifted to the Lusitania fleet, imagining all those starships like riverboats, painted so fiercely, and yet drifting now with the current, so far from the shore that they can no longer be heard, no matter how loud they shout. From dragon boats, her thoughts turned to dragon kites, and now she thought of the Lusitania fleet as kites with broken wings, carried along by the wind, no longer tethered to the child who first gave them flight. How beautiful to see them free, yet how terrifying it must be for them who never wished for freedom. I did not fear the mad winds and violent rain. The words of the song came back to her again. I did not fear mad winds, violent rain. I did not fear as we drank to good fortune with warm blackberry wine. Now I cannot conceive how to retrieve that time. My ancestor of the heart could drink away her fear, thought Ching Zhao, because she had someone to drink with. And even now, alone on my mat with a cup, gazing sadly into nothingness, the poet remembers her gone companion. Whom do I remember now? Thought Ching Zhao. Where is my tender love? What an age it must have been then, when the great Li Qingzhao was still mortal, and men and women could be together as tender friends, without any worry about who was God-spoken and who was not. Then a woman could live such a life that even in her loneliness she had memories. I can't even remember my mother's face, only the flat pictures. I can't remember seeing her face turn and move while her eyes looked at me. I have only my father, who is like a god. I can worship him and obey him and even love him, but I can never be playful with him, not really. When I tease him, I am always watching to be sure he approves of the way I tease him. And Wang Mu, I talked so firmly about how we would be friends, and yet I treat her like a servant. I never for a moment forget who is God-spoken and who is not. It is a wall that can never be crossed. I'm alone now, and I'm alone forever. A clear cold comes through the window curtains, crescent moon beyond the golden bars. She shivered. I and the moon. Didn't the Greeks think of their moon as a cold virgin, a huntress? Is that not what I am now, 16 years old and untouched? And a flute sounds as if someone were coming. I listen and listen, but never hear the melody of someone coming. No, what she heard were the distant sounds of a meal being readied, a clattering of bowls and spoons, laughter from the kitchen. Her reverie broken. She reached up and wiped the foolish tears from her cheeks. How could she think of herself as lonely when she lived in this full house where everyone had cared for her all her life? I sit here reciting to myself scraps of old poetry when I have work to do. At once, she began to call up the reports that had been made about investigations into the identity of Demosthenes. The reports made her think for a moment that this was a dead end, too. More than 36 writers on almost as many worlds had been arrested for producing seditious documents under that name. Starways Congress had reached the obvious conclusion. Demosthenes was simply the catch-all name used by any rebel who wanted to get attention. There was no real Demosthenes, not even an organized conspiracy. But Qingzhao had doubts about that conclusion. Demosthenes had been remarkably successful in stirring up trouble on every world. Could there possibly be someone of so much talent among the traitors on every planet? Not likely. Besides, thinking back to when she had read Demosthenes, Qingzhao remembered noticing the coherence of his writings, the singularity and consistency of his vision. That was part of what made him so seductive. Everything seemed to fit, to make sense together. Hadn't Demosthenes also devised the hierarchy of foreignness? Utlanning, Framling, Raman, Varelsa. No, that had been written many years ago. It had to be a different Demosthenes. Was it because of that earlier Demosthenes hierarchy that the traitors were using the name? They were writing in support of the independence of Lusitania, the only world where intelligent non-human life had been found. It was only appropriate to use the name of the writer who had first taught humanity to realize that the universe wasn't divided between humans and non-humans, or between intelligent and non-intelligent species. Some strangers, the earlier Demosthenes had said, were Framlings, humans from another world. Some were Raman, of another intelligent species, yet able to communicate with human beings so that we could work out differences and make decisions together. Others were Varelsa, wise beasts, clearly intelligent and yet completely unable to reach a common ground with humankind. Only with Varelsa would war ever be justified. With Raman, humans could make peace and share the habitable worlds. It was an open way of thinking, full of hope that strangers might still be friends. People who thought that way could never have sent a fleet with Dr. Device to a world inhabited by an intelligent species. This was a very uncomfortable thought. That the Demosthenes of the hierarchy would also disapprove of the Lusitania fleet. Almost at once, Qingzhao had to counter it. It didn't matter what the old Demosthenes thought, did it? The new Demosthenes, the seditious one, was no wise philosopher trying to bring peoples together. Instead, he was trying to sow dissension and discontent among the worlds, provoke quarrels, perhaps even wars between framlings. And seditious Demosthenes was not just a composite of many rebels working on different worlds. Her computer search soon confirmed it. True, many rebels were found who had published on their own planet using the name Demosthenes, but they were always linked to small, ineffective, useless little publications, never to the really dangerous documents that seemed to turn up simultaneously on half the worlds at once. Each local police force, however, was very happy to declare their own petty Demosthenes, the perpetrator of all the writings, take their bows, and close the case. Starway's Congress had been only too happy to do the same thing with their own investigation. Having found several dozen cases where local police had arrested and convicted rebels who had incontrovertibly published something under the name Demosthenes, the Congress investigators sighed contentedly, declared that Demosthenes had proved to be a catch-all name and not one person at all, and then stopped investigating. In short, they had all taken the easy way out. Selfish, disloyal. Qing Zhao felt a surge of indignation that such people were allowed to continue in their high offices. They should be punished, and severely too, for having let their private laziness or their desire for praise lead them to abandon the investigation of Demosthenes. Didn't they realize that Demosthenes was truly dangerous? That his writings were now the common wisdom of at least one world, and if one, then probably many? Because of him, how many people on how many worlds would rejoice if they knew that the Lusitania fleet had disappeared? No matter how many people the police had arrested under the name Demosthenes, his works kept appearing, and always in that same voice of sweet reasonableness. No. The more she read the reports, the more certain Ding Zhao became that Demosthenes was one man, as yet undiscovered. One man who knew how to keep secrets impossibly well. From the kitchen came the sound of the flute. They were being called to dinner. She gazed into the display space over her terminal, where the latest report still hovered, the name Demosthenes repeated over and over. "I know you exist, Demosthenes," she whispered. "And I know you are very clever, and I will find you. When I do, you will stop your war against the rulers, and you will tell me what has happened to the Lusitania fleet. Then I will be done with you, and Congress will punish you, and Father will become the god of Path and live forever in the infinite West. That is the task that I was born for. The gods have chosen me for it. You might as well just show yourself to me now as later, for eventually all men and women lay their heads under the feet of the gods." The flute played on, a breathy, low melody, drawing Jing Zhao out of herself and toward the company of the household. To her, this half-whispered music was the song of the inmost spirit, the quiet conversation of trees over a still pond, the sound of memories arising unbidden into the mind of a woman in prayer. Thus, they were called to dine in the house of the noble Han Feizhou. Having heard Qing Zhao's challenge, Jane thought, this is what fear of death tastes like. Human beings feel this all the time, and yet somehow they go on from day to day, knowing that at any moment they may cease to be. But this is because they can forget something and still know it. I can never forget, not without losing the knowledge entirely. I know that Han Jing Zhao is on the verge of finding secrets that have stayed hidden only because no one has looked hard for them. And when those secrets are known, I will die. End her, she whispered. Was it day or night on Lusitania? Was he awake or asleep? For Jane, to ask a question is either to know or not know. So she knew at once that it was night. Ender had been asleep, but now he was awake. He was still attuned to her voice, she realized, even though many silences had passed between them in the past 30 years. "Jane," he whispered. Beside him, his wife, Novinia, stirred in her sleep. Jane heard her, felt the vibration of her movement, saw the changing shadows through the sensor that Ender wore in his ear. It was good that Jane had not yet learned to feel jealousy, or she might have hated Novinia for lying there, a warm body beside Ender's own. But Novinia, being human, was gifted at jealousy, and Jane knew how Novinia seethed whenever she saw Ender speaking to the woman who lived in the jewel in his ear. "Hush," said Jane. "Don't wake people up." Ender answered by moving his lips and tongue and teeth without letting anything louder than a breath pass his lips. "How fair are enemies in flight," he said. He had greeted her this way for many years. "Not well," said Jane. "Perhaps you shouldn't have blocked them. We would have found a way. Valentine's writings are about to have their true authorship uncovered." "Everything's about to be uncovered." He didn't say, "because of you." "Only because Lusitania was marked for destruction," she answered. She also didn't say, "because of you." There was plenty of blame to go around. "So they know about Valentine? A girl is finding out, on the world of Path. I don't know the place." "A fairly new colony, a couple of centuries, Chinese, dedicated to preserving an odd mix of old religions. The gods speak to them." "I lived on more than one Chinese world," said Ender. "People believed in the old gods on all of them. Gods are alive on every world. Even here in the smallest human colony of all, they still have miracles of healing at the shrine of Os Venerados. Ruder has been telling us of a new heresy out in the hinterland somewhere, some pecaninos who commune constantly with the Holy Ghost." "This business with gods is something I don't understand," said Jane. "Hasn't anyone caught on yet that the gods always say what people want to hear?"
"Not so," said Ender. "The gods often ask us to do things we never desired, things that require us to sacrifice everything on their behalf. Don't underestimate the gods."
"Does your Catholic god speak to you?"
"Maybe he does. I never hear him, though. Or if I do, I never know that it's his voice I'm hearing."
"And when you die, do the gods of every people really gather them up and take them off somewhere to live forever?"
"I don't know. They never write."
"When I die, will there be some god to carry me away?" Ender was still for a moment. Then he began to address her in his storytelling manner. "There is an old tale of a doll maker who never had a son, so he made a puppet that was so lifelike that it looked like a real boy. And he would hold the wooden boy on his lap and talk to it and pretend it was his son. He wasn't crazy. He still knew it was a doll. He called it Pinehead. But one day, a god came and touched the puppet, and it came to life. And when the doll maker spoke to it, Pinehead answered. The doll maker never told anyone about this. He kept his wooden son at home, but he brought the boy every tale he could gather and news of every wonder under heaven. Then one day, the dollmaker was coming home from the wharf with tales of a far-off land that had just been discovered, when he saw that his house was on fire. Immediately he tried to run into the house, crying out, "My son, my son!" But his neighbors stopped him, saying, "Are you mad? You have no son." He watched the house burn to the ground, and when it was over, he plunged into the ruins and covered himself with hot ashes and wept bitterly. He refused to be comforted. He refused to rebuild his shop. When people asked him why, he said his son was dead. He stayed alive by doing odd jobs for other people, and they pitied him because they were sure the fire had made him a lunatic. Then, one day, 3 years later, a small orphan boy came to him and tugged on his sleeve and said, "Father, don't you have a tale for me?" Jane waited, but Ender said no more. "That's the whole story? Isn't it enough?" "Why did you tell me this? It's all dreams and wishes. What does it have to do with me?"
It was the story that came to mind. Why did it come to mind? Maybe that's how God speaks to me, said Ender. Or maybe I'm sleepy and I don't have what you want from me. I don't even know what I want from you. I know what you want, said Ender. You want to be alive, with your own body, not dependent on the phallotic web that binds the Ansibles together. I'd give you that gift if I could. If you can figure out a way for me to do it, I'll do it for you. But Jane, you don't even know what you are. Maybe when you know how you came to exist, what makes you yourself, then maybe we can save you from the day when they shut down the Ansibles to kill you. So that's your story? Maybe I'll burn down with the house, but somehow my soul will end up in a 3-year-old orphan boy? Find out who you are, what you are, your essence, and we'll see if we can move you somewhere safer until all this is over. We've got an Ansible. Maybe we can put you back. There aren't enough computers on Lusitania to contain me. You don't know that. You don't know what yourself is. You're telling me to find my soul? She made her voice sound derisive as she said the word. Jane, the miracle wasn't that the doll was reborn as a boy. The miracle was the fact that the puppet ever came to life at all. Something happened to turn meaningless computer connections into a sentient being. Something created you. That's what makes no sense. After that one, the other part should be easy. His speech was slurring. He wants me to go away so he can sleep, she thought. I'll work on this. Good night, he murmured. He dropped off to sleep almost at once. Jane wondered, was he ever really awake? Will he remember in the morning that we talked? Then she felt the bed shift. Novinia. Her breathing was different. Only then did Jane realize. Novinia woke up while Ender and I were talking. She knows what those almost inaudible clicking and smacking noises always mean, that Ender was sub-vocalizing in order to talk with me. Ender may forget that we spoke tonight, but Novinia will not. As if she caught him sharing a bed with a lover. If only she could think of me another way. As a daughter. As Ender's bastard daughter by a liaison long ago. His child by way of the fantasy game. Would she be jealous then? Am I Ender's child? Jane began to search back in her own past. She began to study her own nature. She began to try to discover who she was and why she was alive. But because she was Jane and not a human being, that was not all she was doing. She was also tracking Qing Zhao's searches through the data dealing with Demosthenes, watching her come closer and closer to the truth. Jane's most urgent activity, however, was searching for a way to make Qing Zhao want to stop trying to find her. This was the hardest task of all, for despite all Jane's experience with human minds, despite all her conversations with Ender, individual human beings were still mysterious. Jane had concluded, no matter how well you know what a person has done and what he thought he was doing when he did it and what he now thinks of what he did, it is impossible to be certain of what he will do next. Yet she had no choice but to try. So she began to watch the house of Han Feiza in a way that she had watched no one but Ender and, more recently, his stepson Miro. She could no longer wait for Qing Zhao and her father to enter data into the computer and try to understand them from that. Now she had to take control of the house computer in order to use the audio and video receptors on the terminals in almost every room to be her ears and eyes. She watched them. Alone and apart, she devoted a considerable part of her attention to them, studying and analyzing their words, their actions, trying to discern what they meant to each other. It did not take her long to realize that Qing Zhao could best be influenced not by confronting her with arguments, but rather by persuading her father first and then letting him persuade Qing Zhao. That was more in harmony with the path. Han Qing Zhao would never disobey Starway's Congress unless Han Feiza told her to. and then she would be bound to do it. In a way, this made Jane's task much easier, persuading Ching Zhao, a volatile and passionate adolescent who did not yet understand herself at all, would be chancy at best. But Han Feitze was a man of settled character, a rational man, yet a man of deep feeling. He could be persuaded by arguments, especially if Jane could convince him that opposing Congress was for the good of his world and of humanity at large. All she needed was the right information to let him reach that conclusion. By now, Jane already understood as much of the social patterns of Path as any human knew, because she had absorbed every history, every anthropological report, and every document produced by the people of Path. What she learned was disturbing. The people of Path were far more deeply controlled by their gods than any other people in any other place or time. Furthermore, the way that the gods spoke to them was disturbing. It was clearly the well-known brain defect called obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. Early in the history of Path, 7 generations before, when the world was first being settled, the doctors had treated the disorder accordingly. But they discovered at once that the gods spoken of Path did not respond at all to the normal drugs that in all other OCD patients restored the chemical balance of enoughness, that sense in a person's mind that a job is completed and there is no need to worry about it anymore. The gods spoken exhibited all the behaviors associated with OCD, but the well-known brain defect was not present. There must be another, an unknown cause. Now Jane explored more deeply into this story and found documents on other worlds, not on Path at all, that told more of the story. The researchers had immediately concluded that there must have been a new mutation that caused a related brain defect with similar results. But as soon as they issued their preliminary report, all the research ended and the researchers were assigned to another world. To another world. That was almost unthinkable. It meant uprooting them and disconnecting them from time, carrying them away from all friends and family that didn't go with them. And yet not one of them refused, which surely meant that enormous pressure had been brought to bear on them. They all left Path, and no one had pursued research along those lines in the years since then. Jane's first hypothesis was that one of the government agencies on Path itself had exiled them and cut off their research. After all, the followers of the Path wouldn't want their faith to be disrupted by finding the physical cause of the speaking of the gods in their own brains. But Jane found no evidence that the local government had ever been aware of the full report. The only part of it that had ever circulated on Path was the general conclusion that the speaking of the gods was definitely not the familiar and treatable OCD. The people of Path had learned only enough of the report to feel confirmed that the speaking of the gods had no known physical cause. Science had proved that the gods were real. There was no record of anyone on Path taking any action to cause further information or research to be suppressed. Those decisions had all come from outside, from Congress. There had to be some key information hidden even from Jane, whose mind easily reached into every electronic memory that was connected with the Ansible network. That would only happen if those who knew the secret had feared its discovery so much they kept it completely out of even the most top-secret and restricted computers of government. Jane could not let that stop her. She would have to piece together the truth from the scraps of information that would have been left inadvertently in unrelated documents and databases. She would have to find other events that helped fill in the missing parts of the picture. In the long run, human beings could never keep secrets from someone with Jane's unlimited time and patience. She would find out what Congress was doing with Path. And when she had the information, she would use it, if she could, to turn Han Jingzhao away from her destructive course. For Jingzhao, too, was opening up secrets, older ones, secrets that had been hidden for 3,000 years. Ken, Martyr.
Andrew says that we're at the fulcrum of history here on Lusitania. that in the next few months or years, this will be the place where either death or understanding came to every sentient species.
How thoughtful of him to bring us here just in time for our possible demise.
You're teasing me, of course.
If we knew how to tease, perhaps we'd do it to you.
Lusitania is the fulcrum of history, in part because you're here. You carry a fulcrum with you wherever you go.
We discard it. We give it to you. It's yours.
Wherever strangers meet is the fulcrum.
Then let's not be strangers anymore.
Humans insist on making strangers of us. It's built into their genetic material. But we can be friends.
This word is too strong. Say that we are fellow citizens.
At least as long as our interests coincide.
As long as the stars shine, our interests will coincide.
Maybe not so long. Maybe only as long as human beings are stronger and more numerous than we are.
That will do for now.
King came to the meeting without protest, though it might well set him back a full day in his journey. He had learned patience long ago. No matter how urgent he felt his mission to the heretics to be, he could accomplish little in the long run if he didn't have the support of the human colony behind him. So, if Bishop Peregrino asked him to attend a meeting with Covanos Eliejo, the mayor of Milagre and governor of Lusitania, King would go. He was surprised to see that the meeting was also being attended by Oanda Saavedra, Andrew Wigan, and most of King's own family. Mother and Ella. Their presence made sense if the meeting were being called to discuss policy concerning the heretic Pecaninos. But what were Quara and Grego doing here? There was no reason they should be involved in any serious discussions. They were too young, too ill-informed, too impetuous. From what he had seen of them, they still quarreled like little children. They weren't as mature as Ella, who was able to set aside her personal feelings in the interest of science. Of course, King worried sometimes that Ella did this far too well for her own good, but that was hardly the worry with Quara and Grego. Especially Quara. From what Reuter had said, the whole trouble with these heretics really took off when Quara told the Pecaninos about the various contingency plans for dealing with the Descolada virus. The heretics wouldn't have found so many allies in so many different forests if it weren't for the fear among the Pecaninos that the humans might unleash some virus or poison Lusitania with a chemical that would wipe out the Descolada and, with it, the Pecaninos themselves. The fact that the humans would even consider the indirect extermination of the Pecaninos made it seem like mere turnabout for the piggies to contemplate the extermination of humanity. All because Quara couldn't keep her mouth shut. And now she was at a meeting where policy would be discussed. Why? What constituency in the community did she represent? Did these people actually imagine that government or church policy was now the province of the Hibera family? Of course, Oliado and Miro weren't there, but that meant nothing. Since both were cripples, the rest of the family unconsciously treated them like children, though King knew well that neither of them deserved to be so callously dismissed. Still, King was patient. He could wait. He could listen. He could hear them out. Then he'd do something that would please both God and the bishop. Of course, if that wasn't possible, pleasing God would do well enough. This meeting wasn't my idea, said Mayor Covano. He was a good man, King knew. A better mayor than most people in Milagre realized. They kept re-electing him because he was grandfatherly and worked hard to help individuals and families who were having trouble. They didn't care much whether he also set good policies. That was too abstract for them. But it happened that he was as wise as he was politically astute. A rare combination that King was glad of. Perhaps God knew that these would be trying times and gave us a leader who might well help us get through it all without too much suffering. But I'm glad to have you all together. There's more strain in the relationship between piggies and people than ever before, or at least since the speaker here arrived and helped us make peace with them. Wiggin shook his head, but everyone knew his role in those events, and there was little point in his denying it. Even King had had to admit in the end that the infidel humanist had ended up doing good works on Lusitania. King had long since shed his deep hatred of the Speaker for the Dead. Indeed, he sometimes suspected that he, as a missionary, was the only person in his family who really understood what it was that Wiggin had accomplished. It takes one evangelist to understand another. Of course, we owe no small part of our worries to the misbehavior of two very troublesome young hotheads whom we have invited to this meeting so they can see some of the dangerous consequences of their stupid, self-willed behavior. King almost laughed out loud. Of course, Covano had said all this in such mild, pleasant tones that it took a moment for Grego and Quara to realize they had just been given a tongue-lashing. But King understood at once. I shouldn't have doubted you, Covano. You would never have brought useless people to a meeting. As I understand it, there is a movement among the piggies to launch a starship in order to deliberately infect the rest of humanity with the Descolada. And because of the contribution of our young parrot here, many other forests are giving heed to this idea. If you expect me to apologize, Quara began, I expect you to shut your mouth. Or is that impossible, even for 10 minutes? Covano's voice had real fury in it. Quara's eyes grew wide, and she sat more rigidly in her chair. The other half of our problem is a young physicist who has, unfortunately, kept the common touch. Covano raised an eyebrow at Grego. If only you had become an aloof intellectual. Instead, you seem to have cultivated the friendship of the stupidest, most violent of Lusitanians. With people who disagree with you mean, said Grego. With people who forget that this world belongs to the Pecaninos, said Quara. Worlds belong to the people who need them and know how to make them produce, said Grego. Shut your mouths, children, or you'll be expelled from this meeting while the adults make up their minds. Grego glared at Covano. Don't you speak to me that way. I'll speak to you however I like, said Covano. As far as I'm concerned, you've both broken legal obligations of secrecy, and I should have you both locked up. On what charge? I have emergency powers, you'll recall. I don't need any charges until the emergency is over. Do I make myself clear? You won't do it. You need me, said Grego. I'm the only decent physicist on Lusitania. Physics isn't worth a slug to us if we end up in some kind of contest with the Pecaninos. It's the Descolada we have to confront, said Grego. We're wasting time, said Novinia. King looked at his mother for the first time since the meeting began. She seemed very nervous, fearful. He hadn't seen her like that in many years. We're here about this insane mission of King's, said Novinia. He is called Father Estevan, said Bishop Peregrino. He was a stickler for giving proper dignity to church offices. He's my son, said Novinia. I'll call him what I please. What a testy group of people we have here today, said Mayor Covano. Things were going very badly. King had deliberately avoided telling Mother any details about his mission to the heretics because he was sure she'd oppose the idea of him going straight to piggies who openly feared and hated human beings. King was well aware of the source of her dread of close contact with the Pecaninos. As a young child, she had lost her parents to the Descolada. The Xenologer people became her surrogate father, and then became the first human to be tortured to death by the Pecaninos. Novinia then spent 20 years trying to keep her lover Libo, Pipo's son, and the next Xenologer, from meeting the same fate. She even married another man to keep Libo from getting a husband's right of access to her private computer files, where she believed the secret that had led the piggies to kill Pipo might be found. And in the end, it all came to nothing. Libo was killed just as Pipo was. even though Mother had since learned the true reason for the killing, even though the Pequeninos had undertaken solemn oaths not to undertake any violent act against another human being, there was no way Mother would ever be rational about her loved ones going off among the piggies. And now here she was at a meeting that had obviously been called, no doubt at her instigation, to decide whether King should go on his missionary journey. It was going to be an unpleasant morning. Mother had years of practice at getting her own way. Being married to Andrew Wiggin had softened and mellowed her in many ways. But when she thought one of her children was at risk, the claws came out, and no husband was going to have much gentling influence on her. Why had Mayor Covano and Bishop Peregrino allowed this meeting to take place? As if he had heard King's unspoken question, Mayor Covano began to explain. Andrew Wiggin has come to me with new information. My first thought was to keep all of it secret, send Father Estevan on his mission to the heretics, and then ask Bishop Peregrino to pray. But Andrew assured me that as our danger increases, it's all the more important that all of you act from the most complete possible information. Speakers for the dead apparently have an almost pathological reliance on the idea that people behave better when they know more. I've been a politician too long to share his confidence. But he's older than I am, he claims, and I deferred to his wisdom. King knew, of course, that Covano deferred to no one's wisdom. Andrew Wiggin had simply persuaded him. As relations between Pequeninos and humans are getting more, problematical, and as our unseeable cohabitant, the Hive Queen, apparently comes closer to launching her starships, it seems that matters off-planet are getting more urgent as well. The Speaker for the Dead informs me from his off-planet sources that someone on a world called Path is very close to discovering our allies who have managed to keep Congress from issuing orders to the fleet to destroy Lusitania. King noted with interest that Andrew had apparently not told Mayor Covano about Jane. Bishop Peregrino didn't know either. Did Grego? Or Guara? Did Ella? Mother certainly did. Why did Andrew tell me, if he held it back from so many others? There is a very strong chance that within the next few weeks or days, Congress will reestablish communications with the fleet. At that point, our last defense will be gone. Only a miracle will save us from annihilation. Bullshit, said Grego. If that thing out on the prairie can build a starship for the piggies, it can build some for us too. Get us off this planet before it gets blown to hell. Perhaps, said Covano. I suggested something like that, though in less colorful terms. Perhaps, Signora Wiggin, you can tell us why Grego's eloquent little plan won't work? The Hive Queen doesn't think the way we do. Despite her best efforts, she doesn't take individual lives as seriously. If Lusitania is destroyed, she and the Pequeninos will be at greatest risk. The MD device blows up the whole planet, Grego pointed out. At greatest risk of species annihilation, said Wiggin, unperturbed by Grego's interruption. She'll not waste a ship on getting humans off Lusitania, because there are trillions of humans on a couple of hundred other worlds. We're not in danger of xenocide. We are if these heretic piggies get their way, said Grego. And that's another point, said Wiggin. If we haven't found a way to neutralize the Descolada, we can't, in good conscience, take the human population of Lusitania to another world. We'd only be doing exactly what the heretics want, forcing other humans to deal with the Descolada and probably die. Then there's no solution, said Ella. We might as well roll over and die. Not quite, said Mayor Covano. It's possible, perhaps likely, that our own village of Milagre is doomed. But we can at least try to make it so that the Pequenino colony ships don't carry the Descolada to human worlds. There seem to be two approaches. One biological, the other theological. We are so close, said Mother. It's a matter of months or even weeks till Ella and I have designed a replacement species for the Descalada. So you say, said Covano. He turned to Ella. What do you say? King almost groaned aloud. Ella will say that Mother's wrong, that there's no biological solution, and then Mother will say that she's trying to kill me by sending me out on my mission. This is all the family needs. Ella and Mother in open war. Thanks to Covano's Eliejo, humanitarian. But Ella's answer wasn't what King feared. It's almost designed right now. It's the only approach that we haven't already tried and failed with, but we're on the verge of having the design for a version of the Descalada virus that does everything necessary to maintain the life cycles of the indigenous species, but that is incapable of adapting to and destroying any new species. You're talking about a lobotomy for an entire species, said Guara bitterly. How would you like it if somebody found a way to keep all humans alive while removing our cerebrums? Of course, Grego took up her gauntlet. When these viruses can write a poem or reason from a theorem, I'll buy all this sentimental horseshit about how we ought to keep them alive. Just because we can't read them doesn't mean they don't have their epic poems. Fechayas bocas, growled Covano. Immediately they fell silent. Nossa Senora, he said. Maybe God wants to destroy Lusitania because it's the only way he can think of to shut you two up. Bishop Peregrino cleared his throat. Or maybe not, said Covano. Far be it from me to speculate on God's motives. The bishop laughed, which allowed the others to laugh as well. The tension broke, like an ocean wave, gone for the moment, but sure to return. So the antivirus is almost ready? Covano asked Ella. No, or yes, it is. The replacement virus is almost fully designed. But there are still two problems. The first one is delivery. We have to find a way to get the new virus to attack and replace the old one. That's still a long way off. Do you mean it's a long way off, or you don't have the faintest idea how to do it? Covano was no fool. He obviously had dealt with scientists before. Somewhere between those two, said Ella. Mother shifted on her seat, visibly drawing away from Ella. My poor sister Ella, thought King. You may not be spoken to for the next several years. And the other problem? Asked Covano. It's one thing to design the replacement virus. It's something else again to produce it. These are mere details, said Mother. You're wrong, Mother, and you know it, said Ella. I can diagram what we want the new virus to be. But even working under 10 degrees absolute, we can't cut up and recombine the Descalada virus with enough precision. Either it dies because we've left out too much, or it immediately repairs itself as soon as it returns to normal temperatures because we didn't take out enough. Technical problems. Technical problems, said Ella sharply, like building an ansible without a phallotic link. So we conclude nothing, said Mother. We conclude, continued Covano, that our xenobiologists are in sharp disagreement about the feasibility of taming the Descalada virus itself. That brings us to the other approach, persuading the Pecaninos to send their colonies only to uninhabited worlds, where they can establish their own peculiarly poisonous ecology without killing human beings. Persuading them, said Grego. As if we could trust them to keep their promises. They've kept more promises so far than you have, said Covano, so I wouldn't take a morally superior tone if I were you. Finally, things were at a point where King felt it would be beneficial for him to speak. All of this discussion is interesting, said King. It would be a wonderful thing if my mission to the heretics could be the means of persuading the Pecaninos to refrain from causing harm to humankind. But even if we all came to agree that my mission has no chance of succeeding in that goal, I would still go. Even if we decided that there was a serious risk that my mission might make things worse, I'd go. Nice to know you plan to be cooperative, said Covano acidly. I plan to cooperate with God and the Church, said King. My mission to the heretics is not to save humankind from the Descolada, or even to try to keep the peace between humans and Pecaninos here on Lusitania. My mission to the heretics is in order to try to bring them back to faith in Christ and unity with the Church. I am going to save their souls. Well, of course, said Covano. Of course that's the reason you want to go. And it's the reason why I will go, and the only standard I'll use to determine whether or not my mission succeeds. Covano looked helplessly at Bishop Peregrino. You said that Father Estevan was cooperative. I said he was perfectly obedient to God and the Church, said the bishop. I took that to mean that you could persuade him to wait on this mission until we knew more. I could indeed persuade him. Or I could simply forbid him to go, said Bishop Peregrino. Then do it, said Mother. I will not, said the bishop. I thought you cared about the good of this colony, said Mayor Covano. I care about the good of all the Christians placed under my charge, said Bishop Peregrino. Until 30 years ago, that meant I cared only for the human beings of Lusitania. Now, however, I am equally responsible for the spiritual welfare of the Christian Pecaninos of this planet. I send Father Estevan forth on his mission exactly as a missionary named Patrick was once sent to the island of Ayr. He was extraordinarily successful, converting kings and nations. Unfortunately, the Irish Church didn't always act the way the Pope might have wished. There was a great deal of, let us say it was controversy between them. Superficially, it concerned the date of Easter, but at heart it was over the issue of obedience to the Pope. It even came to bloodshed now and then. But never for a moment did anyone imagine it would have been better if St. Patrick had never gone to Ayr. Never did anyone suggest that it would be better if the Irish had remained pagan. Grego stood up. We've found the Philote, the true, indivisible atom. We've conquered the stars. We send messages faster than the speed of light, and yet we still live in the Dark Ages. He started for the door. Walk out that door before I tell you to, said Mayor Covano, and you won't see the sun for a year. Grego walked to the door, but instead of going through it, he leaned against it and grinned sardonically. You see how obedient I am? I won't keep you long, said Covano. Bishop Peregrino and Father Estevan speak as if they could make their decision independent of the rest of us, but of course they know they can't. If I decided that Father Estevan's mission to the piggies shouldn't happen, it wouldn't. Let us all be clear about that. I'm not afraid to put the Bishop of Lusitania under arrest if the welfare of Lusitania requires it. And as for this missionary priest, you will only go out among the Pecaninos when you have my consent. I have no doubt that you can interfere with God's work on Lusitania, said Bishop Peregrino icily. You must have no doubt that I can send you to hell for doing it. I know you can, said Covano. I wouldn't be the first political leader to end up in hell at the end of a contest with the Church. Fortunately, this time it won't come to that. I've listened to all of you and reached my decision. Waiting for the new antivirus is too risky. And even if I knew absolutely that the antivirus would be ready and usable in 6 weeks, I'd still allow this mission. Our best chance right now of salvaging something from this mess is Father Estevan's mission. Andrew tells me that the Pecaninos have great respect and affection for this man, even the unbelievers. If he can persuade the Pecanino heretics to drop their plan to annihilate humanity in the name of their religion, that will remove one heavy burden from us. King nodded gravely. Mayor Gavano was a man of great wisdom. It was good that they wouldn't have to struggle against each other, at least for now. In the meantime, I expect the xenobiologists to continue to work on the antivirus with all possible vigor. We'll decide when the virus exists whether or not to use it. We'll use it, said Grego. Only if I'm dead, said Quara. I appreciate your willingness to wait until we know more before you commit yourself to any course of action, said Covano. Which brings us to you, Grego Hibera. Andrew Wiggin assures me that there is reason to believe that faster-than-light travel might be possible. Grego looked coldly at the speaker for the dead. And where did you study physics, Señor Falante? I hope to study it from you, said Wiggin. Until you've heard my evidence, I hardly know whether there's any reason to hope for such a breakthrough. King smiled to see how easily Andrew turned away the quarrel that Grego wanted to pick. Grego was no fool. He knew he was being handled. But Wiggin hadn't left him any reasonable grounds for showing his disgruntlement. It was one of the most infuriating skills of the Speaker for the Dead. If there were a way to travel between worlds at Ansible speeds, said Covano, we would need only one such ship to transport all the humans of Lusitania to another world. It's a remote chance. A foolish dream, said Grego. But we'll pursue it. We'll study it, won't we, said Covano. Or we'll find ourselves working in the foundry. I'm not afraid to work with my hands, said Grego. So don't think you can terrify me into putting my mind at your service. I stand rebuked, said Covano. It's your cooperation that I want, Grego. But if I can't have that, then I'll settle for your obedience. Apparently, Quara was feeling left out. She arose as Grego had a moment before. So you can sit here and contemplate destroying a sentient species without even thinking of a way to communicate with them. I hope you all enjoy being mass murderers. Then, like Grego, she made as if to leave. Quara, said Covano. She waited. You will study ways to talk to the Descolada, to see if you can communicate with these viruses. I know when I'm being tossed a bone, said Quara. What if I tell you that they're pleading for us not to kill them? You wouldn't believe me anyway. On the contrary, I know you're an honest woman, even if you are hopelessly indiscreet, said Covano. But I have another reason for wanting you to understand the molecular language of the Descolada. You see, Andrew Wiggin has raised a possibility that never occurred to me before. We all know that Pecanino's sentience dates from the time when the Descolada virus first swept across this planet. But what if we've misunderstood cause and effect? Mother turned to Andrew, a bitter half-smile on her face. You think the Pecaninos caused the Descolada? No, said Andrew. But what if the Pecaninos are the Descolada? Quara gasped. Grego laughed. You are full of clever ideas, aren't you, Wiggin? I don't understand, said King. I just wondered, said Andrew. Quara says that the Descolada is complex enough that it might contain intelligence. What if Descolada viruses are using the bodies of the Pecaninos to express their character? What if Pecanino intelligence comes entirely from the viruses inside their bodies? For the first time, Wanda, the xenologer, spoke up. You are as ignorant of xenology as you are of physics, Mr. Wiggin, she said. Oh, much more so, said Wiggin. But it occurred to me that we've never been able to think of any other way that memories and intelligence are preserved as a dying Pecanino passes into the third life. The trees don't exactly preserve the brain inside them, but if will and memory are carried by the Descolada in the first place, the death of the brain would be almost meaningless in the transmission of personality to the father tree. Even if there were a chance of this being true, said Uanda, There's no possible experiment we could decently perform to find out. Andrew Wiggin nodded ruefully. I know I couldn't think of one. I was hoping you would. Covano interrupted again. Wanda, we need you to explore this. If you don't believe it, fine. Figure out a way to prove it wrong, and you'll have done your job. Covano stood up, addressed them all. Do you all understand what I'm asking of you? We face some of the most terrible moral choices that humankind has ever faced. We run the risk of committing genocide or allowing it to be committed if we do nothing. Every known or suspected sentient species lives in the shadow of grave risk, and it's here, with us and with us alone, that almost all the decisions lie. Last time anything remotely similar happened, our human predecessors chose to commit genocide in order, as they supposed, to save themselves. I am asking all of you to help us pursue every avenue, however unlikely, that shows us a glimmer of hope that might provide us with a tiny shred of light to guide our decisions. Will you help? Even Grego, Anquara, and Wanda nodded their assent, however reluctantly. For the moment, at least, Covano had managed to transform all the self-willed squabblers in this room into a cooperative community. How long that would last outside the room was a matter for speculation. King decided that the spirit of cooperation would probably last until the next crisis. And maybe that would be long enough. Only one more confrontation was left. As the meeting broke up and everyone said their goodbyes or arranged one-on-one consultations, Mother came to King and looked him fiercely in the eye. Don't go. King closed his eyes. There was nothing to say to an outrageous statement like that. If you love me, she said. King remembered the story from the New Testament, when Jesus' mother and brothers came to visit him and wanted him to interrupt teaching his disciples in order to receive them. These are my mother and my brothers, murmured King. She must have understood the reference, because when he opened his eyes, she was gone. Not an hour later, King was also gone, riding on one of the colony's precious cargo trucks. He needed few supplies, and for a normal journey, he would have gone on foot. But the forest he was bound for was so far away it would have taken him weeks to get there without the car, nor could he have carried food enough. This was still a hostile environment. It grew nothing edible to humans, and even if it did, King would still need the food containing the Descalada suppressants. Without it, he would die of the Descalada long before he starved to death. As the town of Milagre grew small behind him, as he hurtled deeper and deeper into the meaningless open space of the prairie, King, Father Estevan, wondered what Mayor Covano might have decided if he had known that the leader of the heretics was a father tree who had earned the name Warmaker, and that Warmaker was known to have said that the only hope for the Pecaninos was for the Holy Ghost, the Descolada virus, to destroy all human life on Lusitania. It wouldn't have mattered. God had called King to preach the gospel of Christ to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. Even the most warlike, bloodthirsty, hate-filled people might be touched by the love of God and transformed into Christians. It had happened many times in history. Why not now? Oh, Father, do a mighty work in this world. Never did your children need miracles more than we do.
Ovinia wasn't speaking to Ender, and he was afraid. This wasn't petulance. He had never seen Ovinia be petulant. To Ender, it seemed that her silence was not to punish him, but rather to keep from punishing him. That she was silent because if she spoke, her words would be too cruel ever to be forgiven. So at first he didn't attempt to cajole words from her. He let her move like a shadow through the house, drifting past him without eye contact. He tried to stay out of her way and didn't go to bed until she was asleep. It was King, obviously. His mission to the heretics. It was easy to understand what she feared, and even though Ender didn't share the same fears, he knew that King's journey was not without risk. Novenia was being irrational. How could Ender have stopped King? He was the one of Novenia's children over whom Ender had almost no influence. They had come to a rapprochement a few years ago, but it was a declaration of peace between equals, nothing like the Ur-fatherhood Ender had established with all the other children. If Novenia had not been able to persuade King to give up this mission, what more could Ender have accomplished? Novenia probably knew this intellectually, but like all other human beings, she did not always act according to her understanding. She had lost too many of the people that she loved. When she felt one more of them slipping away, her response was visceral, not intellectual. Ender had come into her life as a healer, a protector. It was his job to keep her from being afraid, and now she was afraid, and she was angry at him for having failed her. However, after 2 days of silence, Ender had had enough. This wasn't a good time for there to be a barrier between him and Novenia. He knew, and so did Novenia, that Valentine's coming might be a difficult time for them. He had so many old habits of communication with Valentine, so many connections with her, so many roads into her soul, that it was hard for him not to fall back into being the person he had been during the years, the millennia, that they had spent together. They had experienced 3,000 years of history, as if seeing it through the same eyes. He had been with Novenia only 30 years. That was actually longer in subjective time than he had spent with Valentine, but it was so easy to slip back into his old role as Valentine's brother, as speaker to her Demosthenes. Ender had expected Novenia to be jealous when Valentine came, and he was prepared for that. He had warned Valentine that there would probably be few opportunities for them to be together at first, and she too understood. Yacht had his worries too, and both spouses would need reassurance. It was almost silly for Yacht and Novenia to be jealous of the bonds between brother and sister. There had never been the slightest hint of sexuality in Ender's and Valentine's relationship. Anyone who understood them at all would laugh at any such notion. But it wasn't sexual unfaithfulness that Novenia and Yacht were wary of, nor was it the emotional bond they shared. Novenia had no reason to doubt Ender's love and devotion to her, and Yacht could not have asked for more than Valentine offered him, both in passion and in trust. It was deeper than any of these things. It was the fact that even now, after all these years, as soon as they were together, they once again functioned like a single person, helping each other without even having to explain what they were trying to accomplish. Yacht saw it, and even to Ender, who had never known him before, it was obvious that the man felt devastated, as if he saw his wife and her brother together and realized, this is what closeness is. This is what it means for two people to be one. He had thought that he and Valentine had been as close as husband and wife can ever be, and perhaps they were, and yet now he had to confront the fact that it was possible for two people to be even closer, to be, in some sense, the same person. Ender could see this in Yacht and could admire how well Valentine was doing at reassuring him, and at distancing herself from Ender so that her husband could grow used to the bond between them more gradually, in small doses. What Ender could not have predicted was the way Novenia had reacted. He had come to know her first as the mother of her children. He had known only the fierce, unreasonable loyalty she had for them. He had supposed that if she felt threatened, she would become possessive and controlling, the way she was with the children. He was not at all prepared for the way she had withdrawn from him. Even before this silent treatment about King's mission, she had been distant from him. In fact, now that he thought back, he realized that it had already been beginning before Valentine arrived. It was as if Novenia had already started giving in to a new rival before the rival was even there. It made sense, of course. He should have seen it coming. Novenia had lost too many strong figures in her life, too many people she had depended on. Her parents, Pippo, Libo, even Miro. She might be protective and possessive with her children, whom she thought of as needing her, but with the people she needed, she was the opposite. If she feared that they would be taken away from her, she withdrew from them. She stopped permitting herself to need them. Not them. Him. Ender. She was trying to stop needing him. And this silence, if she kept it up, would drive such a wedge between them that their marriage would never recover. If that happened, Ender didn't know what he would do. It had never occurred to him that his marriage might be threatened. He had not entered into it lightly. He intended to die married to Novenia, and all these years together had been filled with the joy that comes from utter confidence in another person. Now Novenia had lost that confidence in him. Only it wasn't right. He was still her husband, faithful to her as no other man, no other person in her life had ever been. He didn't deserve to lose her over a ridiculous misunderstanding, and if he let things go as Novenia seemed determined, however unconsciously, to make them happen, she would be utterly convinced that she could never depend on any other person. That would be tragic, because it would be false. So Ender was already planning a confrontation of some kind with Novenia when Ella accidentally set it off. Andrew? Ella was standing in the doorway. If she had clapped hands outside asking for admittance, Ender hadn't heard her, but then she would hardly need to clap for entrance to her mother's house. Novenia's in our room, said Ender.
I came to talk to you, said Ella.
I'm sorry. You can't have an advance on your allowance. Ella laughed as she came to sit beside him, but the laughter died quickly. She was worried. Quara, she said. Ender sighed and smiled. Quara was born contrary, and nothing in her life had made her more compliant. Still, Ella had always been able to get along with her better than anyone.
It's not just the normal, said Ella. In fact, she's less trouble than usual. Not a quarrel.
A dangerous sign?
You know she's trying to communicate with the Descolata.
Molecular language.
Well, what she's doing is dangerous. And it won't establish communication, even if it succeeds, especially if it succeeds, because then there's a good chance that we'll all be dead.
What's she doing?
She's been raiding my files, which isn't hard because I didn't think I needed to block them off from a fellow xenobiologist. She's been constructing the inhibitors I've been trying to splice into plants. Easy enough because I've laid out exactly how it's done. Only instead of splicing it into anything, she's giving it directly to the Descolata.
What do you mean, giving it?
Those are her messages. That's what she's sending them on their precious little message carriers. Now, whether those carriers are language or not isn't going to be settled by a non-experiment like that. But sentient or not, we know that the Descolata is a hell of a good adapter, and she might well be helping them adapt to some of my best strategies for blocking them.
Treason.
Right. She's feeding our military secrets to the enemy.
Have you talked to her about this?
Sta brincando. Claro que fale. Ella quasi me mató.
You're joking. Of course I talked to her. She nearly killed me. Has she successfully trained any viruses?
She's not even testing for that. It's like she's run to the window and hollered, "They're coming to kill you." She's not doing science. She's doing interspecies politics, only we don't know that the other side even has politics. We only know that with her help it might just kill us faster than we ever imagined.
Nossa Senora, murmured Ender. It's too dangerous. She can't play around with something like this.
It may already be too late. I can't guess whether she's done damage or not.
Then we've got to stop her.
How? Break her arms?
I'll talk to her. But she's too old, or too young, to listen to reason. I'm afraid it'll end up with the mayor, not with us.
Only when Novenia spoke did Ender realize that his wife had entered the room.
In other words, jail, said Novenia.
You plan to have my daughter locked up. When were you going to inform me?
Jail didn't occur to me, said Ender.
I expected he'd shut off her access to...
That isn't the mayor's job, said Novenia. It's mine. I'm the head xenobiologist. Why didn't you come to me, Eleonora? Why to him?
Ella sat there in silence, looking at her mother steadily.
It was how she handled conflict with her mother, with passive resistance.
Quara's out of control, Novenia, said Ender. Telling secrets to the father trees was bad enough. Telling them to the Descolata is insane.
Es psicologista, ajuda.
Now you're a psychologist. I'm not planning to lock her up.
You're not planning anything, said Novinia.
Not with my children.
That's right, said Ender.
I'm not planning to do anything with children. I do have a responsibility, however, to do something about an adult citizen of Milagre who is recklessly endangering the survival of every human being on this planet and maybe every human being everywhere.
And where did you get that noble responsibility, Andrew?
Did God come down to the mountain and carve your license to rule people on tablets of stone?
Fine, said Ender.
What do you suggest?
I suggest you stay out of business that doesn't concern you. And frankly, Andrew, that includes pretty much everything. You're not a xenobiologist. You're not a physicist. You're not a xenologer. In fact, you're not much of anything, are you, except a professional meddler in other people's lives.
Ella gasped. Mother, the only thing that gives you any power anywhere is that damned jewel in your ear. She whispers secrets to you. She talks to you at night when you're in bed with your wife. And whenever she wants something, there you are in a meeting where you have no business, saying whatever it was she told you to say. You talk about Quara committing treason. As far as I can tell, you're the one who's betraying real people in favor of an overgrown piece of software.
Novinia, said Ender. It was supposed to be the beginning of an attempt to calm her. But she wasn't interested in dialogue.
Don't you dare to try to deal with me, Andrew. All these years I thought you loved me. I do. I thought you had really become one of us, part of our lives. I am. I thought it was real. It is. But you're just what Bishop Peregrino warned us you were from the start. A manipulator. A controller. Your brother once ruled all of humanity. Isn't that the story? But you aren't so ambitious. You'll settle for a little planet.
In the name of God, Mother, have you lost your mind? Don't you know this man?
I thought I did.
Novinia was weeping now.
But no one who loved me would ever let my son go out and face those murderous little swine.
He couldn't have stopped King, Mother. Nobody could.
He didn't even try. He approved.
Yes, said Ender.
I thought your son was acting nobly and bravely, and I approved of that. He knew that while the danger wasn't great, it was real, and yet he still chose to go, and I approved of that. It's exactly what you would have done, and I hope it's what I would do in the same place. Keying is a man, a good man, maybe a great one. He doesn't need your protection, and he doesn't want it. He has decided what his life's work is, and he's doing it. I honor him for that, and so should you. How dare you suggest that either of us should have stood in his way?
Novinia was silent at last, for the moment anyway. Was she measuring Ender's words? Was she finally realizing how futile, and yes, cruel, it was for her to send King away with her anger instead of her hope? During that silence, Ender still had some hope. Then the silence ended.
If you ever meddle in the lives of my children again, I'm done with you, said Novinia. And if anything happens to King, anything, I will hate you till you die. And I'll pray for that day to come soon. You don't know everything, you bastard. And it's about time you stopped acting as if you did.
She stalked to the door, but then thought better of the theatrical exit. She turned back to Ella and spoke with remarkable calm.
Eleonora, I will take immediate steps to block Quara from access to records and equipment that she could use to help the Descolada. And in the future, my dear, if I ever hear you discussing lab business with anyone, especially this man, I will bar you from the lab for life. Do you understand?
Again, Ella answered her with silence.
Ah, said Novinia,
I see that he has stolen more of my children from me than I thought. Then she was gone. Ender and Ella sat in stunned silence. Finally, Ella stood up, though she didn't take a single step.
I really ought to go do something, said Ella. But I can't for the life of me think what.
Maybe you should go to your mother and show her that you're still on her side.
But I'm not, said Ella.
In fact, I was thinking maybe I should go to Mayor Zelyerzhel.
and proposed that he remove Mother as head xenobiologist because she has clearly lost her mind. No, she hasn't, said Ender. And if you did something like that, it would kill her. Mother? She's too tough to die. No, said Ender. She's so fragile right now that any blow might kill her. Not her body. Her trust. Her hope. Don't give her any reason to think you're not with her, no matter what. Ella looked at him with exasperation. Is this something you decide, or does it just come naturally to you? What are you talking about? Mother just said things to you that should have made you furious or hurt, or something, anyway. And you just sit there trying to think of ways to help her. Don't you ever feel like lashing out at somebody? I mean, don't you ever lose your temper? Ella, after you've inadvertently killed a couple of people with your bare hands, either you learn to control your temper or you lose your humanity. You've done that? Yes, he said. He thought for a moment that she was shocked. Do you think you could still do it? Probably, he said. Good. It may be useful when all hell breaks loose. Then she laughed. It was a joke. Ender was relieved. He even laughed, weakly, along with her. I'll go to Mother, said Ella. But not because you told me to, or even for the reasons that you said. Fine, just so you go. Don't you want to know why I'm going to stick with her? I already know why. Of course. She was wrong, wasn't she? You do know everything, don't you? You're going to go to your mother because it's the most painful thing you could do to yourself at this moment. You make it sound sick. It's the most painful good thing you could do. It's the most unpleasant job around. It's the heaviest burden to bear. Ella the martyr, certo. Is that what you'll say when you speak my death? If I'm going to speak your death, I'll have to pre-record it. I intend to be dead long before you. So you're not leaving Lusitania? Of course not. Even if Mother boots you out? She can't. She has no grounds for divorce, and Bishop Peregrino knows us both well enough to laugh at any request for annulment based on a claim of non-consummation. You know what I mean. I'm here for the long haul, said Ender. No more phony immortality through time dilation. I'm through chasing around in space. I'll never leave the surface of Lusitania again. Even if it kills you? Even if the fleet comes? If everybody can leave, then I'll leave, said Ender. But I'll be the one who turns off all the lights and locks the door. She ran to him and kissed him on the cheek and embraced him just for a moment. Then she was out the door and he was, once again, alone. I was so wrong about Novenia, he thought. It wasn't Valentine she was jealous of, it was Jane. All these years, she's seen me speaking silently with Jane, all the time, saying things that she could never hear, hearing things that she could never say. I've lost her trust in me, and I never even realized I was losing it. Even now, he must have been sub-vocalizing. He must have been talking to Jane out of a habit so deep that he didn't even know he was doing it, because she answered him. I warned you, she said. I suppose you did, Ender answered silently. You never think I understand anything about human beings. I guess you're learning. She's right, you know. You are my puppet. I manipulate you all the time. You haven't had a thought of your own in years. Shut up, he whispered. I'm not in the mood. Ender, she said, if you think it would help you keep from losing Novenia, take the jewel out of your ear. I wouldn't mind. I would, he said. I was lying, so would I, she said. But if you have to do it to keep her, then do it. Thank you, he said. But I'd be hard-pressed to keep someone that I've clearly lost already. When King comes back, everything will be fine. Right, thought Ender. Right. Please, God, take good care of Father Estevan.